welcome to I'll Look Into It. I'm your host, Tony Yang. Today, we're talking with author Vanessa Hua and her work. Vanessa Hua is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and author of Deceit and Other Possibilities, which received the Asian Pacific American Award for Literature and is a finalist for the California Book Award. Oh, the Oprah magazine called it a stunning debut. She received a Rana Jaffe Foundation Writers Award, the San Francisco Foundation's James D. Phelan Award, a Steinbeck Fellowship in Creative Writing, as well as honors from the Society of Professional Journalists and the Asian American Journalists Association. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, The Atlantic, Frontline/World, Washington Post, Zizivia, and elsewhere. She has filed stories from China, South Korea, Panama, Burma, and Ecuador. Her novel, A River of Stars, is forthcoming. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Do you have any memories, first, since this is a UCR-based program, of the UCR MFA program?
Oh, many. In fact, I was there this spring when I was one of the speakers at Writers Week, which was one of my favorite events each year. In case your listeners haven't heard of it, it's when the creative writing department invites journalists, writers, poets from around the country to read on campus. So, of course, it was like a dream come true to be able to come back. And I knew the library had a copy of my book, so I went and looked it up because I really wanted to see it on the shelves. And when I got there, I discovered it was actually next to a copy of my MFA thesis. I mean, I was sort of shocked because I knew the school had a copy of it, but I just hadn't touched those pages in years, right? And it was like, oh, it's out in the open for anyone to check out if they want. So, but my MFA thesis is actually the novel that's going to be published, that is going to be the second book of my two-book deal. But it's just funny that, like, it felt like this blast from the past in the form of my MFA thesis. But sure, I mean, I remember going to the getaway and getting pictures after workshop, strolling around on campus, hanging out with friends, discussing creative writing and gossiping and all that. So I have very fond memories of UC Riverside.
Well, you know what you're supposed to do is, for those of us who finished our dissertations and is somewhere in the library, the tradition has been for us to put a dollar bill in there because we can go back and check if anybody's actually opened it, because they would have taken the dollar bill.
Unless you had someone exceptionally honest who checked out your book. No,
I really doubt that. My dissertation was very boring. It was on life insurance.
Well, the next time I go to campus, I will have to put a dollar bill in.
Please do. So let's begin. What prompted you to collect these stories in Deceit and Other Possibilities? Because that's the work we're really talking about here. What's the motivation behind it? You've been to various different places in the world, but why this? Why these stories in particular?
Well, I didn't set out to write around a particular theme. I wrote these stories story by story over a period of a decade. First, when I was working on staff full time as a reporter covering the Asian American community, I'd work on it before work or on weekends. And eventually I went to grad school at UCR where I wanted to focus on my novel, but I still kept writing short stories. And as I accumulated a stack, I eventually realized that, I had enough to fill a book, and that actually in every single case, the stories revolved around immigration and identity, and also around the secrets and lies, the secrets that we tell ourselves and our families, the well-intentioned lies, because we think it's, the only way to preserve peace and prosperity, even if in the end those lies are actually self-serving and destructive.
I think all the stories have that sort of narrative. I in particular remember your story about Eileen Park.
Or Asia Kim.
Yeah, Asia Kim. And that was a very interesting story. You want to tell a little bit about how you came to kind of write that story?
Sure. So I don't. There was a case at Stanford back in 2007. I don't know if you heard about it at the time, but she had told everyone that she'd gotten into Stanford. She was Korean American. Told her folks that she got a scholarship through ROTC, which explained why they didn't have to pay tuition. She got to campus and, you know, somehow convinced people that they should let her stay with her in their dorm. But then by the end of the year, she was going to class, taking tests, going to study groups. But by the end of the year, she got found out. She hadn't gotten in, but she'd been carrying on this ruse all year. And I just thought that was so fascinating. But I didn't write a story immediately. It actually didn't come about until later when I started to notice other examples. There was a case at UC Irvine, you may have heard of. He was South Asian, and he told his parents that he'd gotten into med school. And they arrived for graduation. He went so far as to rent a robe and jump into the procession until someone who actually was enrolled in med school kind of pulled him out and said, This guy isn't graduating. This guy isn't a student. And then there was a case at Riverside even also a few years ago where he might have been Vietnamese or Chinese American, but he called he didn't tell his parents he'd failed out. His parents were coming for graduation, and he called in a bomb threat, and he planted Molotov cocktails around campus. So these stories taken collectively, you know, aren't to indicate that all Asian Americans, you know, start con their way into college. But I really wanted to explore what might lead someone to go down this path, that how a series of small lies snowball and you find yourself maintaining that lie because just there's no other way out. And how it's particular in some sense to that the immigrant experience, that awareness that your parents have sacrificed so much, and you know, and yet there's this, it's unspoken, and there's that sense of guilt, and how it can lead to literally explosive consequences because there's just no other way of, there's no way of trying to face your parents for having disappointed them.
I think that's a very sort of interesting sort of common denominator within Asian American culture. I mean, the whole concept of filial piety, right? The honor your parents runs through all these narratives. And I just find it very fascinating that that's at the heart of your work. And I found myself connecting to it in a very unusual way because it's not my lived experience, right?
Yeah.
It's very different. I told my parents I wasn't going to go to computer science and blah, 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 whatnot.
Relationship survived.
And my relationship somehow survived. And so, you know, I become a professor, and then I get the Asian students are like, well, how do you tell your parents that you're not going to go to pharmacy school? I'm like, you just do. Consequences. It's not like I have a magic bullet. But that I did that was very different than I think what a lot of peers and what a lot of other people did. But in reading the book, I had the same sort of guttural feeling that I think many other Asian Americans who were reading the book might have felt about filial piety, issues around truth and shame and these sort of things, and totally understanding why someone would go to those extremes to really kind of, you know, save face, right?
Yep, definitely. And yet, I think this character, I didn't want her to make an object of pity. Like, there were some who said when the case that kind of was one of my inspirations happened, they thought, well, the fact that she was able to be resourceful enough to pull this deceit off for the entire year, that in a way should have granted her entry into Stanford. So there's something about the wiliness that that kind of intrigued me and wanted me to kind of understand this character more.
No, and I think that's so interesting because I think, you know, for me, having been an instructor at the university level, if students put half the effort into studying that they do to cheating, they would have passed. It would have been okay, right? I mean, that's the sort of thing. Had she applied to maybe Berkeley, I mean, heaven forbid that you had to go to Cal instead of Stanford. That would have been so bad, you know, or one of those things. But at the same time, I think in the Asian American culture, we kind of feel that pressure, you know, to succeed. And I think it's a very real, real pressure. So I think that's a certain, a very interesting aspect to the work. And I do encourage our listeners to read it. But the other element that's really strong in all of this work, and I think is very unique within the culture and lexicon is, at least within your work, is this idea of transnationalism in your story. You have people who are intermediating through multiple cultures in multiple locations. Was that a conscious choice to include that in your stories, or is that just something that out of your own experience you wanted to write from that perspective?
I mean, I think I always start with the character and the situation first rather than saying like, well, I want to demonstrate, you know, A, B, or C. But just from the fact of having covered Asian American issues and the community for, you know, from on both sides of the Pacific, for almost two decades, you just hear these stories. And I think there's this narrative in this country that immigration is one way. You arrive, you don't look back. When in fact, you know, I was just talking to someone tonight for a story I'm working on. And, you know, I've heard of this where because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, men would come and father children, men would come and work here and then have to go back to China and they would have their son and then the son would immigrate in the next generation and so on and so forth. So you have these, this circular migration, these multiple generations of migration. It's far from one way. Or even as a journalist, I wrote about this trend of Asian American stars who go to Asia to find fame and fortune because of the barriers they face in Hollywood. And so just, I found that so fascinating, that idea that you go back to the very place your parents left to make a better life for you, and just sort of like the complications of that. I just, we live in a very different world now where we're connected by internet, by jet travel. And I just think it really plays with these notions of identity that are not part of the dominant narrative, but in fact are just people's lives and how they're living and what they're thinking and feeling.
Well, and I think in that sense, the character Kingsway is a very excellent lens into that, right? Trying to find success in a very sort of amorphous way, and he finds it, but then he's stuck in sort of this duality between two countries and two very different places.
Right. That's so for your listeners, Kingsway is my character is someone born and bred in the Bay Area, always felt like an outsider, ended up getting discovered in Hong Kong, but then got caught up in a sex scandal. So had to flee back to a place where he wouldn't be known, wasn't famous. That is, back to his hometown. So he's caught between cultures, not American enough and then not Chinese enough. And it was just, I had a lot of fun with that character. And he's a favorite of some of my readers. They're like, is there more about him? And I have written more pages. So who knows? We might be seeing more of Kingsway again.
Well, you may have to go that route and sell it to a Korean production company. They may be able to turn it into a Korean drama that's right, now inundated right, right. the market all over the place. And I think that's kind of interesting. I mean, it parallels really the phenomenon of the Korean rapper Psy, right? Because he came here, is educated here, he speaks fairly fluent English, but he didn't achieve major stardom until he went to Korea and started doing really bad rapping. And it was a caricature of it. And then he has one video that goes global. And then everybody's like, wait, who is this guy? Wait, what? He was here. I find that's kind of a fascinating thing about, you know, having a foot in both countries and, you know, using
that
to
kind of stuff. Oh, I didn't realize Cy had spent some time in the U.S.
Yes, he's educated here. He's educated in the United States, you know, in K-Town. He's plugged in with the Korean community here. And he was a very straight and narrow individual before he went back to Korea and found major stardom. This is, in fact, there's a... if I am correct, there is a huge culture of K-pop, of American, Korean American K-pop people who are here and then go to Korea.
I remember reading some profile. I think there was a Stanford student who was Korean American. He went back and found stardom in Korea. And then there's Daniel Henney, who's been in Korea for a while. He's biracial, but he has become a star in Korea, even though, you know, he's as American as they come, right? Yeah. So you go where the opportunities are.
I'd like to remind you that you're listening to I'll Look Into It. And today we're speaking with author Vanessa Hua about her work, Deceit and Other Possibilities. One of the other things that's, I think, and ended up being a thematic element, but particularly the name of the story escapes me right off the top of my head, where you have two... Asian Americans at various different points camping, and their identities and consciousness kind of split between I belong here, I don't belong here, I'm a perpetual outsider, but I'm with the group. I found that so deeply fascinating in your writing, and you do it so well. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. And that particular story. Thank you. And thank you for your kind words. You're referring to my story for what they shared.
Yeah.
And I think of it as my FOB versus ABC story. That is to say, fresh off the boat is one character and the other character is ABC, American born Chinese. And so, often to outsiders, Chinese Americans, Asian Americans appear to be this monolith, right? Like, black hair, speak Chinese, all look same. When in fact, there's all these intra-group tensions that I wanted to explore. That, do you spend time trying to find connection, or in your haste to become more American, do you kind of like turn your back on the people that remind others of your foreignness? And in the end, if you're both sort of attacked by the more dominant culture, is that enough to make you feel a connection? I also really was drawn to this setting of camping because it is this very American assimilated sort of activity. Because if you're not that far removed from sleeping on the ground, if your parents or your grandparents did or you yourself did, you have no interest in driving somewhere and plunking down money and putting down expensive gear to again sleep on the ground. So I just wanted to play with that setting as well in terms of thinking about assimilation and what it means to be an American.
I thought that was very fascinating because I think I think there are always different modes of thinking and approaching that. You have this wonderful story where a postdoctoral or very brilliant student who's here hosting her parents goes to REI, buys all the equipment, as if that's the symbol of Americana. Now I go to REI all the time, so that's probably bad for me. But
you get a refund back at the end of the year, right?
Yeah, I also like their warranty that they'll take anything back. I don't know how that probably makes me more Asian than I think. It's again one of the brilliant reasons why to read the book, because I think these sort of cultural nuances that you're pointing out are really very important, and I think a good inflection point for people who want to maybe reflect upon society and culture and their place in it. And I think that's a very healthy thing to do, particularly given the society that we're currently living in. Which has become much more angry, much more marked by tribalism right?
Right. And I think it's only that happens when we demonize a group, when we don't hear their stories, we don't try to understand their dreams or their histories. So whether it's in my nonfiction or fiction, I've always tried to tell that untold story. And even if in the end you still don't agree with the decisions they've made, you at least understand what got them there.
One of the other things that I really wanted, and I love because I'm a Bay Area native, is that your story is focused on the Bay Area and a very expansive region of the Bay Area. You did, unfortunately, slightly leave out my end of the Bay Area, which was the South Bay, but that's okay. it's a little bit more boring. It's a little bit more boring, but I can live with that. But you really focused on it. And I found it very interesting because you take a very long historical arc to it. And in particular, you touch base quite a bit in the Mission District in San Francisco, which is a very vibrant community that is facing a lot of changes. And much like the rest of the city, losing some character or transitioning. You know, how do you, as a native Bay Area and someone who, you know, frequently works and works out of San Francisco, feel about that?
Well, I remember when I lived in San Francisco, I moved back. I had worked on the East Coast and had moved back here in 1999 at the height of the first dot-com boom. And I got an apartment in the Mission and I'm thinking, okay, I'm driving my Jetta. Am I gentrifying this neighborhood? but then the thought occurred to me, if I'm even asking that question, I am. So you know, what does that mean though? What responsibilities do I have to helping preserve the culture or acknowledging and respecting the people who are already living here? And, you know, there were, in some ways, I almost feel like the battles were even more pitched back then. There were, you know, people were getting their cars keyed and, you know, there was this. But I don't know if that, but if anything, Valencia Street is even more ridiculous now, right? I remember I was in a boutique and I saw this chair where the arms were made of trombones and the seat was actually a speaker, and it was a $6,000 chair. And I thought, who is buying this? And in fact, who is running this store? Is it someone who made a lot of money in tech and then thought it'd be fun to open a boutique with $6,000 trombone chairs? But yet at the same time, I do acknowledge that cities change, right? I mean, I remember talking to people or just, you know, the Mission has long been a neighborhood of immigrants, Irish, immigrants, you know, the successive waves. It wasn't really Latino until, closer to the 70s. So there is this hope that like the very things that draw people to a neighborhood, that element can be preserved. And I mean, it's just sort of a larger question of like, what is San Francisco doing to preserve affordable housing for the people who live and work there, that it doesn't just become this toy city for one class of worker. So I mean, the changes that are happening in the Mission are happening, you know, all over the city, but just accelerated in the Mission.
Yeah, I think your next story will be about middle income Asian American teacher working in San Francisco, just barely trying to get by on $75,000 a year, you know, which is in its own sense would be very sad.
Well, my friend actually, she's a columnist for the Chronicle as well, and she covers the city and government, but she wrote about an African American teacher who was homeless.
Yeah.
Like she still went to work, but she was homeless. And that's just not acceptable. There needs to be like all levels of housing available. So
the other aspect that I think you talked about, and I don't know how much you want to speak to this, but is this new influx of individuals, and you mentioned it in your book, which was, you know, new people who arrived in the city trying to out-local the locals.
Right, right.
I think that's a very funny dichotomy, and I have a good friend of mine. She's born and bred, raised in San Francisco, and she's always deeply offended by people who attempt to out-local the local. How much of that did you witness over the years, or have you witnessed over the years?
Yeah, I mean, you that they're people do it because they're actually trying to stake a claim to a place that they're new to, right? This is part of their attempt to try and be from a place by challenging people who are actually from that place. Everyone's trying to stake a claim. It's always that question of like, well, what are metrics? You know, the very fact that you even know about it, hasn't that somehow made it inauthentic? You've spoiled it with your presence. So it's all very tricky. But it is this thing where, you know, people love cities and are drawn to it for a certain reason, but their very presence changes it, right? Schrodinger's cat. You cannot observe something without changing it.
Well, and that's one of the interesting things, I think, to kind of bring this back full circle. All these stories are about immigrants and some of their immigrant experience. You know, well, how do you feel about some of your characters? Are they attempting to lay claim to part of the American narrative and to part of the narrative of belonging here? Or are they just trying to get by and trying to get fortune or to try and make ends meet? Because part of what I came away with was their desperate attempt to claim the sort of American dream for everybody.
Right. And I mean, in that the American dream is as old as the pilgrims arriving here, and it's as new as the immigrant who's arriving at SFO, right?
Yeah.
Today. Mm-hmm. So, but it's a complicated dream, and there's a sacrifice that's made, and the only way you can sort of justify that sacrifice is by thinking your future is going to get better, if not for you, then for your children. So there is a looking ahead. And I mean, I don't know if they necessarily see themselves as part of the American narrative. Maybe, I don't know if any of my characters are necessarily readers, I would think, but I do think they are hoping for a sense of belonging. And in some ways I do hope that stories like theirs do put them in the narrative, so that it's not just one type of story and one type of American that is considered as the true definition of American.
Well, and from that, from the bottom of my heart, I really was moved and touched, because I think what you're doing is very wonderful, documenting these stories and making sure that they're told. Because I do remember years and years ago, as an undergraduate student, I took a class on Asian American diasporadic literature. And there weren't these stories quite yet. And I think these stories are so important to tell. So I want to thank you for that. But I'm also sorry that we're all out of time. Our guest today has been Vanessa Hua. She is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle and author of Deceit and Other Possibilities, which received the Asian Pacific American Award for Literature and is a finalist for the California Book Award. Her novel, A River of Stars, is forthcoming. Our producer has been Clark Price. Our engineer has been Elliot Fong. I'm your host, Tony Yang. Tune in next time for more I'll Look Into It. Thank you for listening.